really zip through written conclusions because we have a lot to talk about military records. So, but I just want to make sure everybody has an understanding of what they are. And I did bring some examples. First of all, the written conclusion. It's the fifth element of the genealogical proof standard. Does everybody remember what the genealogical proof standard is? Good. Okay, because that's important. Even if you're not interested in doing this professionally, you're just doing it for family members, you still want to adhere to those guidelines because that's going to help you when you have very difficult questions or issues, but it's also going to help you to stay on the straight and narrow so that all of a sudden you don't discover at some point you're researching in somebody else's family. Because as I said to you before, and I'm going to remind you of this, you get attached to these people. I'm a little sad that with my Samuel Armbruster, now I'm doing everything I was supposed to do, and it just took me about 3 years, now granted I was doing this off and on, but it took me about 3-4 years before I realized, you know, his father isn't Samuel Armbruster and his mother isn't Hannah Clifton. It's Isaac Armbruster and Catherine Rowe. Well, yeah, I'm only one brother off, but I really like the Cleaver family. And now I'm not a member of the Cleaver family. So, you know, that's just, look, I was doing everything I was supposed to do, and sometimes that happens. But if you really, if you're talking about something and you find your own family and you're not still investigating like I was. Because believe me, I hadn't attached everything onto my tree. I knew that this was still very questionable. So I really hadn't committed to that family, but I really did like the Cleveland line. And actually, my main reason for liking it is that if they actually go back to the Potts family of Pottsburg Manor in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and I'm in a historic dance troupe, and we danced at Pottsburg Manor.
You do historic dancing?
Yes. So
I did that for years.
Okay. So I actually, my eighth great grandmother, I used to say my eighth great grandmother and I have danced on the same floor. But I can't say that now. So who knows? You know, when you're in a little community, people intermarry a whole lot. So maybe I'll get my Cleavers back again at some point. But just remember that. All right. So, the fifth element is a reasoned and coherently written conclusion. That's really important. You have to write something so somebody can understand what you're saying. You've been living and breathing and eating this, so you know exactly what you mean. But what I end up doing is I end up writing something, and then I give it to somebody who's not a genealogist, who has not heard of this before, to make sure they can understand exactly what I'm saying. And that's really important. Because I'm sure you have run across texts in family genealogies or something, and you just keep rereading it over and over and over again because you're not even sure what it is they're saying. You don't want to do that to other people. So, all right. And there are three different forms of writing up and proving your research conclusion. And the first one, proof statements. I love it when you can do that. They're nice and short. We'll get into it. Proof summaries, again, they're a little bit shorter too. Proof arguments. These are the guys when you have, you know, my Joseph Feldman, I have 14 different documents. I'm going to have to walk people through that. I'm going to have to explain my reasoning. So that's going to take a while to explain that. So again, depending on what you have to explain, you may need a proof summary and a proof statement. It's just a data item or a sentence accompanying the source that is contained in a thoroughly documented context. So in other words, if there are minor conflicts or no minor conflict or it's direct evidence, you just have to make a statement. This person was born this date, this place. Here's the document that shows that. It's just a statement. All right. Proof summaries. Lots of times these are used when you're doing lineage, and I do have a sample of that, and we'll look at that in a minute. A proof summary, it's a narrative or list with documentation, and it's used when evidence is direct or very little conflicting. So if you don't have, and you'll actually see in the example that I show you in a few minutes, that it's a lineage that I'm doing for somebody, and with some things, I'm making a statement, and then I give my source. But other times, I have to explain it. I have to take it step by step by step. All right, and again, proof arguments. This, you are going to need not only narrative, but very often tables, if that makes it easier for the person to understand. It may involve figures where you are calculating numbers, and you need to show that to somebody. And again, it is going to depend, and usually these are done when you do not have direct evidence. Usually more in the indirect evidence area. I'm not going to talk a lot about this. The best way to learn how to do it is to do it. You know, is anybody unclear about what I'm talking about in terms of a simple, basic, straightforward example or a complicated one? Don't be afraid to say you're not. I want to make sure everybody understands that. Because I remember when I first started doing this, I'm like, they want me to break something up. And I was always picturing this long narrative. It doesn't have to be that. For the statements, when it's just right, it's a statement. A summary. Yes?
Would this be on each of your proof, your census? Would this describe your census to what it means to
No, and I'm going to show you. I'm going to stop here and I'll show you because I think that will make sense. This may be a lost slide on this one because I think it's more helpful if I show you. So let me get this up and hopefully I can. All right. I cannot put this on. There we go. All right. So this is basic. This is a lineage. And here I'm just saying, okay, generation three, we've got Howard Walters Smedley and Matilda Walters. So for Howard Walters Smedley, I say when he's born and where, and I've got a Pennsylvania death certificate and a number. Now, in some cases, I may need to go into more detail, just in terms of where I'm getting that, and that's important. And I will actually fill that in here, because you can get a death certificate from the state, or you can get it from the county. So here, before I send this off to the client, I will be saying where that this is going to be a state, the state health department. And just because it's Pennsylvania or does not mean that it might not necessarily, it may have a county name in Pennsylvania. So if this actually was a county, I would have said Montgomery County, Pennsylvania certificate number. But even still, after that, after the number, I'm going to be indicating Pennsylvania State Health Department. All right, and then the next one.
Don't you say it there?
I beg your pardon?
You said it in front of it, or you need to say it behind?
No, that just says Pennsylvania death certificate. That does not say where I'm getting it from.
No, county or state.
So I need to indicate Pennsylvania State Health Department. I may even put what is Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and then the certificate number. Now, and then again, I'm referencing the same one. Here, again, a death certificate. Here, so do you see how this is just statements? Mm-hmm. There's really nothing here other than stating the piece of information or the data point and then citing your source. these sources are not properly done yet. So that's the one thing I want to tell you. I just pulled in a piece of work that I was currently working on. Okay. And then we have the marriage, and again, Delaware vital record, certificate of marriage, and the number. The connecting document, I'm saying parents of Howard Walter Smedley are Jesse G. Smedley and Annie Johnson, PA death certificate number. So, and again, I would only list the Pennsylvania State Health Department up at the top here. If I'm repeating it, I won't keep doing that. Yes.
And this is true because you have found just one fact and you're relying on it. If there were another, if there were a church record that had a different year, you wouldn't be a statement at that point.
Yes, I would. If you are talking about someone who has really varied information, then yes. And again, it also depends on its purpose. So if I'm doing a family history and I'm giving this to my family, my purpose is to make sure everybody understands that life of that individual. So I'm going to include all kinds of things with conflicting information. If I have something here this is tricky. The whole point of this is to get her into colonial days. Okay? That's the whole issue. She wants to be in colonial days. So the colonial days at this point, this is the tough part between balancing as a professional and as doing it for yourself. As a professional, I'd be wasting her money if I kept writing long proof arguments. Because that's not what she needs to get in. And she really doesn't want to pay me for that. But if I were submitting this for certification, you bet if I had any kind of conflict, I would be talking it out. Here, as long as I am satisfied that this is accurate and I have looked at all the conflicts and I've weighed them out and measured it, I'm not going to be listing all that on her application. So again, for my own purposes, for my own family, I would want to include everything, and I would want to explain it. But if somebody's paying me by the hour, and the purpose is to get her into the colonial days, and I do see that these are accurate pieces of information, honestly, if you're talking about a day off here and there, or even a year off here and there, if it makes not a bit of difference in terms of what the goal is and who the person is, that's not going to be an issue. So do you understand how you really are doing this? What is your purpose? How are you doing this? Again, as I said, if somebody's willing to pay me, then yeah, I'll write all the proof arguments you want me to. Yes?
Didn't you tell us some earlier class that the death certificate is a secondary record for birth and for the parents? So isn't there conflict there? The fact that the birth came with the death certificate and the parents came with the death certificate?
No, that's not a conflict. That's how I'm analyzing it. If I got another document that conflicted with the birth, seriously, then that's a conflict that I have to address. And I would be weighing and balancing it, because which is the more reliable in terms of birth? A baptismal record or a death record? A baptismal record. But here's the thing. There is no conflict. And what is going to be the fastest way for me to get her in there with one document that proves two things as opposed to multiple documents that are only going to say the same thing? So that's where, again, this is, and I have to tell you, when I first became a professional, this was really hard, because I was not including everything like I do for my own family work. But that's not what I'm being paid to do here. I'm being paid to provide accurate information, but as concisely and as efficiently as I possibly can. That may or may not be what you're going to be doing. My what?
Oh, jeez.
Okay, not my computer. Save this.
Okay. Hold on. And I'll have to sign it. All right, there we go. All right, now what I want to do is get a little bit further down where I do have a conflict. All right, and again, you have to understand the other thing that I'm doing is I'm also providing all the documentation. So with all of this, there's going to be copies of every single one of these records along with it. So they will be able to examine this as you go along. But again, this is the write-up. This is the summary. And that's what this is. This is a summary. There are summaries within, and there are actual statements in here, too. But let's get to... Okay, I'm going to go to Generation 5. The generation that drove me crazy. All right, no, I take that back. Here we go. Generation 6. George Smedley and Elizabeth Mallon. Man, George made me crazy. All right, so George, the only place I could find any record of the date of his birth was this death announcement that appeared in the newspaper of the Delaware County Republican, Chester, Pennsylvania. I named the issue, the volume number, microfilm, etc., etc. Delaware County Historical Society and the address. And I said, the announcement read, and I would also have an image of this as well, but I put, the announcement read on the 11th instant in Springfield, George Smedley Sr. in his 93rd year of his age. And I hear, he was most likely born in Pennsylvania since his parents lived in Chester County, Pennsylvania during the 1870s. And I will have included with his parents documentation that show that they lived only in Chester County during the 1780s. So again, I'm supporting where. Date of death, and that's clearly stated in there. And then we get for his wife, she was a piece of cake. Her birth was listed in the Quaker records, which was fabulous. And then it states that she was the daughter of Thomas and Grace Mallon. And then her death appeared in the Delaware County Republican. Thank God for that newspaper for me, because I would have never been able to finish this.
Delaware County.
What?
It's Delaware County.
Oh, man, this was a bear. Hold on.
Is that a newspaper you could just go to, or did you have to go through newspapers.com?
No, I had to go to the Delaware County Historical Society and look through paper after paper. Now, I was very lucky because someone had preceded me who had done some research on the Smedleys, and they had listed some of these, but some of the information did not, so I had to try to start looking. And if you ever look at the Delaware County Republican, the death notices are itty, bitty, 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 and it's not always on the same page, and it's not always in the same column, and they don't have a header. So it was miserable searching. Even sometimes when I had exactly where it was, what issue it was, it took me 45 minutes one time to find the death notice in that issue. So this is just grueling work. All right, so their marriage. This is fun. We know when George Smedley and Elizabeth Mallon were married because Elizabeth Mallon was a member of the Society of Friends and in good standing until a complaint was made in the Chester Monthly Meeting of Women's Friends held at Providence on the 28th of April, 1817, Chester Preparative Meeting. The entry reads, Chester Preparative Meeting informs Elizabeth Smedley, formerly Mallon, have kept company and accomplished her marriage with a man not in membership with friends by the assistance of a magistrate. Notice no punctuation. And Darlington and Mary Yarnell are appointed to take a suitable opportunity with her and report of her disposition to the next meeting. All right, so that proves that this Elizabeth Mallon married a Smedley. But it's not proving which Smedley. So I have more work to prove. And that is, also, we know that the Smedley Elizabeth Mallon marries is George Smedley, since on the 21st of December, 1840, George Smedley submits a caveat against the probate of Thomas Mallon's will in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, 1841. The caveat states, I, George Smedley, intermarried with Elizabeth Mallon, one of the daughters of Thomas Mallon, late of Chester, deceased, do hereby enter the caveat, blah, 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 blah. And then I indicate where I found that.
Is this a proof argument?
This is a proof argument, absolutely. Because I'm showing we've got two pieces of indirect evidence. Without both of them, I cannot prove the date and the place of marriage. The only thing that I have that says they were married was that complaint against Elizabeth Mallon, Smedley, but it doesn't indicate who, what Smedley she's married. But the other document I have does indeed have the George Smedley that I'm tracking saying that he did marry an Elizabeth Mallon, the daughter of Thomas, but it doesn't give me any date at all.
And you couldn't find the gravestone?
No, neither of these people have gravestones because they were buried in a Quaker cemetery, but they were not Quakers in good standing. Therefore, there is no record, and very often in Quaker cemeteries, there are no stones. Therefore, they are, and there are some stones, but in this case, there are not. So, no marriage record, no death records for George or Elizabeth other than the newspaper, and no birth record for George at all. So, the only way I was able to get any kind of birth, target, pinpoint, was the death announcement in the newspaper. So is everybody getting an understanding now of what you need to do? And it may have been clear as day to you or to me if we put these two documents side by side in here and didn't give an explanation. But the explanation makes it clear. It explains my reasoning, and I'm forming my conclusion and supporting it. Everybody clear on that? All right, now we have to move on to military records. Hang on to your hats. All right, military records. And one of the reasons I was trying to combine two different programs that I've done, because I thought you'd really enjoy. All right, researching military records. This is an area that I specialize in because I adore military records. You can get pieces of information on military records that you can't find anyplace else. One of the first things I investigated was, did George Smedley serve at all? Did he have a pension anywhere? That would have solved my problem. Guess what? George served nowhere. So I didn't, all military records were out for me. All right, first of all, what are military records? Because I want all of you to expand your definition on this. Any document concerning military operations, facilities, equipment, or personnel. Wow. That includes a lot, doesn't it? And you need to keep that in your head. The reason why I say this is because almost everybody that I talk to, when they think about military records, want to zoom to the National Archives and Records Administration, and they don't think about anything else. Or the Personnel Records Center down in St. Louis, Missouri. Military records are all over the place. You just have to find them. All right. First of all, for genealogical purposes, for this, we're going to focus mainly on service records and records pertaining to veterans' benefits, so pensions. That doesn't mean there aren't more of them, but there's a limit as to how much we can cover. All right, so we have federal resources and records. We have state resources and records. We have county and municipal records. We have specialty libraries and museums. We have historical and lineage societies, and we have internet sources. Do not just check federal records and say you've done searching your military records. You are going to be missing out on some really wonderful documents. Not only that, if you only rely on federal record sources, you may mess some of the service completely. And I'll explain that in a minute. All right, who are in military records? Anyone who served in emergency, in any emergency action through voluntary enlistment or draft, and they appear in the compiled military service records if the War Department was able to identify them. Career military, these are officers that have received a commission, and you will find them in the register of enlistments. And then other female service members, Army Nurses Corps, American Red Cross nurses. Please let's not forget these ladies. And then civilians. Civilians can be found in pension applications, court records, and hospital records. So you need to look. Just because your person wasn't in the service doesn't mean that they're not going to appear in some service records if at the same time they were in a hospital that was providing services for military personnel. They may be listed right in there with the rest of them. All right, what types of federal military records are there? We have compiled military service records. We've all heard of these, or many of us have heard of these. We have pension records. And under pension records, we've got pension application records, and we also have pension payment records. Rarely does anybody think about the pension payment records. And then we have bounty land records. And under bounty land records, we have bounty land applications, which very often are kept in the pension application files. And then we have surrendered bounty land warrants. These are going to be in the land record. So we are talking about a totally different record group at the National Archives.
And what are they? Surrendered warrants.
We're going to get into that.
Okay.
So you're so excited, and I appreciate that.
Yeah,
but we're going to get to that in a minute. And of course, yeah, we're jumping right in there with you. Okay, so we have. Where are the federal resources and records? Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., National Archives and Record Administration, Washington, D.C. and College Park, and Personnel Records Center, and that's in St. Louis, Missouri. These are the major places that you will find federal military records. And each one, for example, the Library of Congress has so many different maps and documents on the different wars, battles, conflicts. Now, are they personnel records? No, they're not. But we have to get off the idea that there's going to be this wonderful, fat, juicy personnel record that's going to tell you all the information about your ancestors. You may get lucky, and that may be the case, but in other situations, you're going to have to build that military record. So, all right, then we have the National Archives and Records Administration. I would be referring to that as NARA. Get used to that term. If you're talking to genealogists, it's going to be NARA. Any kind of pension record, most of the military records and the compiled service military records and the pension records are all kept at NARA in Washington, D.C. Now, I throw College Park up there because they have all kinds of military records that are not personnel-related military records. So if all of a sudden you're interested in a carrier that somebody served on, you may want to go to College Park. But the other thing you're going to want to do before you do any research at NARA, mail away for this book. I think it's around $43. Best purchase you'll ever make if you're going to be researching the National Archives. It's in your handout. But Guide to Genealogical Research in the National Archives of the United States. Now, this is really important. Third edition. Do not try to go online and buy this. I'm telling you this because I did, and what they sent me was the second edition. Second edition is very good. It has almost exactly the same information in there, with the exception of the photographs of the different documents. I think the photographs of the different documents is critical. So you can familiarize yourself as to what this record, the type of record, looks like before you even get up there.
Where's that in the notes?
I beg your pardon?
You said it was in today's notes?
It's under the military.
Yeah,
bottom of page 3, right here. Earls and Brewer and Robert, Guide to Genealogical Records. Trust me, I will not leave that one off because it's probably the most important one when you start to do military records. Yes.
Have you been to Maryland?
Yes, I have been to Maryland.
Going there on Friday.
Okay, great. Hold that thought.
Okay, good.
Okay. Now, you can go online. The NARIN has a catalog, and I love, for many of you heard of Tom Jones, he's one of the big genealogists in the field. I love what Tom Jones says about NARIN's website. He says, NARIN's website was created by a crazy person. So it may not necessarily be the easiest to navigate, which is why I think you need that. You can also go online, and they have finding aids. They don't print them out anymore like this, but they have finding aids, and you can access them online as well. You're going to need to spend some time on the NARIN catalog website, or on the NARIN website, to understand how it works or how it doesn't work. But you do need to get familiar with it, because remember what I said about this is an archive. Part of their task that they've been assigned with is not to catalog the items or store the items in a format that's easiest for us to use. They are tasked with storing the records as they were at the time of the record's use. Therefore, there may be 18 different places that your person's name appears. But you may have to check 18 different record groups. And there is not one lovely index that is going to have you look up that person's name and say, oh, check record group 49, check this, check this, check this. It doesn't work that way. You have to try to figure out where your person may have intersected with the government and go to that record set and look, depending on how that record set is actually stored. Is it stored by last name? Is it stored chronologically? How is it stored? And different record sets are going to be stored differently. This is not easy, but you will find things here that's fantastic. So it's worth the trouble. All right, now then. Okay, and the Records Personnel Center. First of all, the records stored at the National Archives are all the records from prior to World War I. So any conflict that happened prior to World War I is going to be at the National Archives. Anything after, including World War I and to the present, is stored at the Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri. All right. And again, original federal records and documents, World War I to present day. All right. Let's talk about what's at the National Archives and Records Administration. Now, they have the compiled service military records. They have pension application records. They have pension ledgers and payment vouchers. They have bounty land records. And they have post-war claims. Now, post-war claim, some person might argue, is not a military record. I don't believe that. thing that somebody had said. The army marched through my land, totally destroying my crops, killing all my livestock. You, United States government, owe me money. So they're going to have those records in there as well. One of the places that you can find that, and I believe I do not have this on this handout, so you will want to write that down. There's a website called A Century of Lawmaking. And this has all the documents of Congress. And anyone that made a post-war claim was a private claim, and it was submitted to Congress. And Congress would have to decide, is this person entitled to reimbursement or not? A Century of Lawmaking. If you Google that, it will come up. And then you're going to want to look at what they call the Congressional Serial Set. And they do have indexes to this. So if you go on there and you type your person's name, even though they may have never served in the military, but there's family stories that the Army marched through, you may find records on your ancestor. Okay. While I'm remembering this, I'm going to take a little break. I cover government records like the Century of Lawmaking in foundations, too. I don't do it in foundations. Why? Out of curiosity, if we offered foundations, too, this spring, how many of you would sign up for it? It would be at the same time, same day. 17. Okay, because we cannot offer it unless there are enough takers, and I promise that I would take a rough count. And the prerequisite is that you have taken foundation. So one of our reasoning was that we had offered it last spring, and we had already graduated 3 classes of foundation. So I'm trying to see if we may have enough for the spring.
So it's still be the 8 weeks?
I believe it may only be 5 weeks. Now I'm wondering, how sad is that? Okay. All right, okay. Be kind, be gentle. All right. Federal records history. This is important to understand this because most of the pre-1801 records were destroyed in 2 fires, one in 1800 and the next one in 1814 that was part of the War of 1812. That's a real bummer. However, because of the fire of 1814, that's why we now have the National Archives and Record Administration. So something good did come out of that. But what did the government do when this happened? The War Department gathered substitute records from other government departments and private sources. So what they ended up doing is they went out to other government departments and said, okay, you do have copies of these records, we need them. And so they tried to reconstitute the records that they had. They did this definitely for the Revolutionary War. They also went to private record collectors. People that were collecting records for the Revolutionary War. So think about it. This is in, after 1814? That's a lot of years after the war. That's why I'm saying that if you cannot find a compiled military service record for your person, that does not mean they didn't serve. And if you only check the federal records, you are seriously limiting yourself. You may find a fabulous write-up of the people that served and in what unit they served in a local county history or in town meeting minutes. That's why you don't just want to look at the federal level. Plus, if you look at the federal level, you're going to miss any kind of militia record. Because the militia was all managed by state and local governments. So you're not going to find any militia records there. They're all at the state level and at the local level. They may make reference to them in some of the federal, but that doesn't mean you're going to have any kind of record of a particular name. Unless, of course, they scooped them in and they were required to serve in the Continental Army, which did happen. All right, so few pension records exist prior to the Act of 1818. And then the compiling of military service records began circa 1892 under the direction of Colonel Frederick Ainsworth. 1892. So how many conflicts came and went before we're starting to gather information on individuals and what their service was? This whole project started because Congress started to pass various acts supporting veterans of the Revolutionary War. Because they were hearing that certain veterans were starving, and Congress thought this was horrible. So they wanted to provide pensions. One problem, though. If you don't have personnel records, how do you prove their service? So the pension office was going crazy trying to prove people's military service. So that's when the Compiled Military Service Record Project started under Ainsworth. Now, I have to say, Ainsworth did an amazing job. I think he was one of those people that it was great to assign him this, but you would never want to work with him, and you would never want to have to work with him. And consequently, he was so difficult to work with that he actually retired early because he was trying to avoid court-martial, that he had annoyed so many people, because it was his way or the highway. And I think he said that too many times. They were like, okay, it's the highway. So he said, thank you, I'm retiring. Which presents a problem in and of itself. This project was never finished. So it is only the compiled military service records that Ainsworth's organization got to finish before he had to quick retire before he got a court martial. So in and of themselves, they are incomplete. So let's look at how they were created. Let's look at what they look like and how they were created and how they work. Because this is important. Because they are not the original records. They were records that were compiled after the fact. Again, this started in around 1892. So here we have, here we have the envelope or jacket for Whittington Clifton, who served in the Revolutionary War. Now, one of the things you need to understand, Whittington Clifton, this is the level that he came in, private. This is the level, his rank, when he went out. So he went in as private and he went out as private. This is a regiment he served in, Colonel Hall's Delaware Regiment. Now, you see all these wonderful numbers. May I hope all of your compiled service military records have this many numbers? I believe it's 36. For every number that's on here, there is a corresponding card inside this envelope. So there should be 36 cards in this envelope. And that's when I say, oh, goody, good. Now, down here, this is a bookmark. These numbers, very often, this will mean that it will say, I believe, what is it? Something in pensions, number 488276. Hopefully, you're going to get that one as well. What does that mean? Most likely that a pension was applied for and they may have gotten it, or this may be the application number. It could be the certificate number or the application number. However, it can also mean other things. So sometimes you have to talk to them at NARA to help you figure out what is the other document you need to go for. But if you have any numbers down there, that means there are other records that you need to be looking for. Oh, and let's go back, hold on. And of course, for the Revolutionary War, they are found on Fold 3. All of the compiled military service records are on Fold 3. And then, of course, they also are in there. Yes?
Where exactly do they get?
We're getting to that. Again, I'm so excited with everyone's enthusiasm. That is the next couple of slides. All right, now here are three of the cards that were in that envelope. So we have this one here that says payroll. We have one that is a return, and it's of clothing and necessities. And here is one for, it's basically reporting on the people who were not showing up on the muster roll. So it's a return telling where these people were. So here are three different cards, and on the back of these, they will have numbers. And as I said, those numbers will correspond to what we saw on the front of the card, right here. And each of them have a different number. Now, how are these cards generated? What are they made up from? Let's take a look at that. Okay, wait a second. Hold on, okay. Before we take a look at that, we are going to... Usually in those envelopes, there are only those cards. Sometimes you will only have an envelope and no cards in it. Lots of times you'll have maybe two cards or one card. So these are usually... Actually, you want to check the pension record application records first, and then these. And I'll explain that to you in a minute. I was lucky, and in my Samuel Arm Priester's jacket, it also contained this document. This document is a substitute volunteer enlistment document. And it was a real gem because, one, it told me that Samuel Arm Priester was age 21 and 2 months. 2/12. That is the only place I have gotten his birthday down to months. Then it also tells me his occupation. He was a bricklayer. It also, I'm able to calculate when he was born because this document was created in 1864 in August. So we know he was born in June of 1843. And then last of all, and then also, it shows me this is a man who is either illiterate or, given that he's German, cannot write his name in English. He might be able to write it in German, but not English. My guess is that he was illiterate. But again, be careful of your assumptions. And the other piece of this that I love is it says, this soldier has gray eyes, light hair, his light complexion, and is 5 feet, 8.5 inches high.
Oh, wow.
So I have no picture of Samuel Arm Priester. This is as close as I'm going to get. But now I have an idea of what he looked like. I also understand why I'm only 5'1" and 3/4. So, all right. Now, the question was, the information on the abstract cards came from regimental or other unit or department documents or records, enlistment papers, muster rolls, payrolls, hospital and medical records, prisoner of war records, supply and clothing records, descriptive books, and casualty reports. Now, does everybody know an enlistment record is when you were volunteering or starting in the Army, they had a document. And one of the things that you need to understand is some of these documents are enormous. They would take up the size of this table. But that's because they were out, they knew they needed to write a lot down, and it was easier to take a nice big piece of paper. And they just made little teeny lines. So that's an enlistment paper. A muster roll is basically an attendance list. When should you start to be appearing in this regiment? And when should you not be appearing in this regiment? All right, payrolls, their money. The others are more self-explanatory. A descriptive book, And this is why they have on that form, why they were describing Sammy Arm Priester's appearance. If you deserted, they wanted to know what you looked like so they could come and look for you. So that's why they filled out all of this information on what, how you looked. And then, of course, casualty reports, I think, self-explanatory. So let's take a look at this. Here's our abstract card, and that's what those little cards are called, the abstract cards, because they are abstracted information from a regimental or department document. In essence, they're an abstract. All right, and this is the return document from the Revolutionary War rolls. Remember I told you how the government tried to collect all the records? The collection of that is called the Revolutionary War Rolls on Ancestry. Okay, let's take a closer look at this. All right, I'm looking at this little box. What does it say? All right, this is saying this sheet is trying to explain who are the people that are not appearing on the muster roll, and why? So we have this section that says privates on extra duty. When, where, what are they doing? And lo and behold, we have Whittington Clifton. So every time any man's or woman's name appeared on any of these documents, they would take out a little abstract card, and they would fill it out for them. And then they would take all those cards for Whittington and put them in one envelope. So you could see, you could have various people working on various regimental documents, and then they'd collect all the cards for a unit or division and then put them in all the appropriate envelopes. Does everybody understand the process now? That's going to help you. It's really important to understand that when you're going through these. So, we have Whittington, there's Whittington, and he's in Hull's Regiment of Delaware, it's Company C, he's a private. Okay, then it says, when did he go out on private duty? September 5th, 1779. And it says right here, on extra duty, when? September 5th, 1779. Where? State of Delaware. There it is, State of Delaware. And what is he doing? And I love this. Waiting on Colonel Hull. That answered a whole lot of questions for me. Because I couldn't understand on some of these supply cards that I was seeing, Whittington wasn't getting any, he wasn't getting a gun, he wasn't getting coat, he wasn't getting anything. And the other soldiers were. Because I went to the actual documents, and one of the places for Delaware that you can see is the Delaware Archive Series. And it's a collection of transcribed documents, all in this wonderful collection. And you can get it online. But I can see all the other soldiers are getting coats, are getting socks, are getting whatever. Whittington's getting nothing. I realized he's waiting on Colonel Hull. He's getting all of Colonel Hull's hand-me-downs. He doesn't need anything. He's being kept in a nice, cushy place where it's warm. Yeah. He is truly Colonel Hall's valet. He's taking off his coat, putting it on. When it gets warm enough, he's keeping it himself. So he had a pretty good gig going there. But again, this explained it all to me. So honestly, these cards, if you're lucky, you can truly track your person through the conflict if they have the number of cards that went into them. But you have to look at them and track them. All right. Other pension records. All pension-related documents should be investigated. So what are they? We have pension application. We have pension ledgers. We have pension payment vouchers. And we have the last and final payment. And we have bound land files and post-career correspondence. You want to look at all these things. So first of all, the pension application, I'm going to show you lots of examples of those. Those are fabulous. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get into the pension ledgers, payment vouchers, final payment, pension. We are going to be talking about boundary lines. The reason, but the reason why these are so important is that if you don't know where your person is, these are going to tell you. The way the pensions worked is they were paid twice a year, every 6 months. And if they didn't mail it to your house, you indicated a bank that you would go to pick up your pension. So these banks across the country in various places had contracts with the government, and every 6 months the government would send to this bank so much money, and it was up to you or somebody that was legally, you could legally deputize to go and pick up this money for you. So where your person is getting paid is again giving you a clue as to where they were at a certain time and place. So you need to investigate these. Now, the last and final payment, pension payment, what do you think that's going to tell us? What would be the last time they get paid? They're dead. So are they getting money? No. Their heirs are getting it. So all of a sudden, you get a nice tip-off as to who their heirs are. So that's why you want to investigate those records. And again, we don't have enough time to go through that process, but you need to understand that. So if you are going down to the National Archives, you can ask them and they can help you with this. There are, some of them are online, and I do indicate that later on. All right, pension files. They are at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Some of them are on Gold III, not all of them. All of the Revolutionary War are. It's going to be a long time before the Civil War ones are all on there, but some of the Civil War ones are on there. Ancestry.com has some of them. ProQuest, whoops, and ProQuest. Now, one of the things I need to make you aware of is that, again, we talked about this with Ancestry. Ancestry is going to take a bunch of different things and bundle it all in one name and call it one database. So you need to understand, and where are you going to find this information? No, what it is. If you find a document on Ancestry and you want to know exactly where it came from, what record group, what are you going to do? Yes, the original source on the record page. You know how they have the document page and then they have the record page. So you want to look at the record page at the bottom and see where it says source. And then it's going to say original source. This is going to give you the microfilm number at NARA. So then you will be able to look and see, okay, what is that true? What is the name of that true collection that Ancestry has thrown together? Because that's going to give you more information about where other places, you know, you may want to look that aren't on Ancestry or Gold III. All right, this is a copy of Whittington Clifton's pension jacket or the envelope. Again, this is bigger. The pension records have more information in them. Now, one of the things you need to understand is the compiled military service records don't have a whole lot of genealogical information in them. I was lucky. I found that substitute volunteer service, and that did give me information about what he looked like, where he was born, what his occupation was, and his birthday. Most of those things are not going to be found in the compiled military service record. So when you look at a compiled service military record, it is exceedingly difficult sometimes to determine, is this my Samuel R. Priester or is this somebody else's? The only clue that you're going to get is where they, what state they served under. That's not a whole lot. So I always recommend to people that you look in, you look for pension application or pension information first. And then if you find it, you can always then find the compiled service military record. And of course, if you don't find they have any pension application, then you want to look at the compiled service military record and try and figure it out. The other thing I need to mention to you is with compiled service military records, people have enlisted more than once, and they may not have all joined those services together. So my Samuel Armpriester actually enlisted three different times. He has three different envelopes with three different units. I think he liked the money. So, yes.
If he joins three different times, would he have three different service numbers?
What do you mean by service number?
And I'm realizing, as I said, that service numbers might not be.
There are no serial numbers.
Okay.
Not now.
Okay.
Okay? But he would have, he might have three different cards.
Right.
Or they might have put them all in one. You just don't know. Again, was this finished? Was this completed? No. Did all the records, all the regimental documents survive so that they could create cards for your person? No. A whole lot of them didn't. And that information is gone. But it may be that on the local level they may have something. Yes.
Really basic question. On those cards, the word return, what does that literally mean?
It was a return, it was a document that was returned back to the headquarters that stated something. So it could have been how many supplies were given. Or it could have said, okay, these are people that were not on the muster roll. This is a return that basically is stated. They're not here. This is why. It could have meant a lot of different things. And you'll see when you look on them, you'll start figuring out exactly what it was. Was it supplies? Was it payroll? Was it...
some kind of like record of something.
Yes.
Okay.
All right? Okay, so when we look at this right here for this pension jacket envelope, we're going to see over here it says service. He served under the state of Delaware. So it's going to have a state over here. It's going to have his name here. Oh, look, there are two variations on how his name is spelled in here. They were able to get them together. With my Samuel, at one point, he is named Samuel Armbrister, B-R-I-S-T-E-R, and Armbrister and Armpriester. They did not combine. Somebody was not cop on that these were the same individual. And then over here, you're going to see a number. This letter can mean survivor for S, widow, reject, or C for certificate. Now, a survivor or widow is indicating the type of pension they were applying for. Were they a survivor? Were they a widow? And you may have two applications in the same file. So if your person applied for a survivor's pension, got it, went in the files, then later he dies and, oh, his widow is applying for the widow's pension, and her application goes in the same envelope, which is very, very nice. Now, it may say rejected. Then it's saying, most likely, this may be the number of the application or the number of the survivor certificate of the pension. So if you were approved, you got a pension number. So you have an application number, and you have a pension, if you got it, a pension number. So there is a number for you. If it's rejected in the number, it's just basically the number for the application. And if it's a certificate, it may say it's a certificate. So again, I guarantee you, one of you is going to see a different letter up there than the ones I've just told you about. In which case, you're going to have to find out what that means. But these are the ones you're going to see most. All right, this is a trifold, and this is for, again, Whittington Clifton. And up here, this is going to be, That is going to be a pension number, and I believe that's an R for the Revolutionary War. And here, it's going to indicate that he's Whittington Clifton of Lewis in the state of Delaware, who was a pilot in the regiment commanded by Colonel David Hall, D. Hall, of Delaware, of the Delaware Line for the term of 2 years. He's inscribed on the roll of Delaware at the rate of $8 per month to commence on the second quarter of April, 1818. certificate pension issued the 9th of July, 1819, and it says something Samuel Patton, so that's it's sent.
Yeah. It looks like the word sent.
Okay, and that's Ridge, wait a second, something Lewis Delaware. But then this, here it says, appears on the 4th of March, 1819, 10 hours. So he's getting back pay because what's here? This is the act that Congress passed. They passed an act, the 18th of March, 1818, revolutionary claim. So he's going to get a pension starting from that day. Now, he may not apply for it until the following year. Because keep in mind, a lot of people didn't even know they were eligible for some of these things. And then it took them a long time to apply for it and get approved. But they did collect back pay. So it was really wonderful when you got a pension. $129.56, that's pretty good.
Twice a year? Once a year.
It depends on the conflict and the time of when it was offered. Now, the other thing you need to understand, and I better not have lost my train of thought, okay, is as I said, Congress would pass these acts saying we feel that anybody that served in the Continental Army should get a pension if they can prove that they are in need. And if you serve for longer than 6 months. So they issue. Then a year, a couple months go by, and they say, well, we feel if you served for 3 months, you're entitled to a pension. Now, keep in mind, they kept issuing these acts as more and more of the veterans died from conflict. It cost the government less and less money, but they looked really, really generous. So they got more and more generous as things progressed, as time passed. So initially, you may have had to serve 2 years, but then after another 10 years, you may have only needed to serve one, then 6 months. So again, you have to see, you're going to have to understand what the act says. So you're going to have to know what the act says. And one of the wonderful books, hold on, where is it? Here we go. Military Pension Laws by Christine Rose from 1776 to 1858. She put all of them in here. Fabulous book. So that way, that helps you understand how long somebody did serve. If you know what the act was and the date and your person's getting it, that's giving you more clues. All right. The other thing is, yes, it may have been that when people's service were finished, they were issued a little note by their commanding officer. But most likely, they were just said, okay, thank you, see you later, go home. They had no documentation. So how did they prove this? Well, a good portion of these were proved by affidavits and depositions. And this is where you get great information. So this is Whittington Clifton's pension application affidavit, and in it, it includes his nativity, his age, his current address, his military service, which includes the enlistment details, some of the battles, separation details, and names of fellow soldiers. So you think it's really important to read these things with a fine-tooth comb? You betcha. Why? Because let's take a look at this. Right up here, could not find any kind of proof of birth for Whittington, except in here, it says in the year of our Lord, 1818, he's 55 years old, and he's swearing to this. So we know he's born in 1763. Now that I've said how wonderful these are, here's my word of caution. Do you think these are always right? Do you think these are always accurate? If somebody has a nice pension to collect for the rest of their life, there's a motive not to be completely honest if you know that you needed to serve 2 years and maybe you only served one, or you needed to serve 6 months and you only served three, whatever it is. So you do have to keep that in mind. But sometimes this may be the only thing that you have. So with that in mind, we may be at the mercy of people telling us information because they wanted attention. But always think about that and make sure it correlates with everything else that you're finding on this individual. All right, this is a marriage return that was in one of the Civil War widows' pension applications. They made these people prove a lot. You had to prove when you were married to the person. If you had children, you had to give the birthdays. Why? Because if for any child that was 16 or under when the soldier died, you got an additional $8. An additional $2 a month. Widows did get $8, but you got an additional $2 for every child that was under the age of 16. That is pretty darn good. So in this one, poor dear, Virginia Clifton turned this in trying to collect a widow's pension, not for herself, because she had remarried, and if you remarried, you did not get it. But she thought that maybe her children would be entitled to it, because indeed, a number of them were under 16 when he died. The fact that she remarried, she didn't get it. But I was still very happy that she submitted all this, because on this document, are you ready for what I'm able to find? The wife's maiden name, the wife's father's name, the wife's mother's maiden name, the birth date of the wife, the birth location of the wife's father, the birth location of the wife's mother. Now, it doesn't get much better than that. Two maiden names on one document, and that was not the only thing that I found in this pension application. Now, this is another one. This is from the Civil War, and you can see here she's listed all her children's names and the birth dates. And actually, she does not list, she only lists the ones that were under the age of 16. But again, she's going to list in here their marriage date, when he served, and the children, and when they were born. That's fabulous. She's doing all the work for you. And then here's another one. This one is from Armpriester. Again, we're back to Armpriester. And again, it lists wife's maiden name, marriage place, marriage date, death date for soldier, current residence, names of the children, birth dates of the children, baptism dates for the children, and location of baptism. So what is that giving me? Now I need to go to the church and I'm going to find all kinds of things. I may find multiple generations of that church. So these are a gold mine of information for you. All right, here's a widow's pension for 1812. And this is a widow's application for bounty land for Elizabeth Clifton, for the soldier Asa Clifton in the state of Delaware. This is the only place I could find the marriage. Could not find the church. I don't believe those records survived. So this was the only place I could find it. All right. Pension payment records. Yes?
In pension records I've seen, they had to prove it wasn't just the date of death of the soldier. They had to prove that he died. So you get a death certificate in there.
Mm-hmm. You get death certificates, or you get statements from doctors.
Yeah.
And again, I hesitate to use the term, I hate to use the term death certificate. You get death records from various sources. So yes, these are really fabulous, fabulous files. All right, the pension payment records, that's going to be in the accounting office of the Department of Treasury, and that's record group 217. And that's in Annals. All right, the original ledgers, and these are ledgers of payments from 1888 to 1872, are going to be under United States pensioners under the Acts of 1818 through 1858, and that's microfilm T718. But if all of you get that fabulous book,
You don't have to be scrambling right now writing these things down, because it's going to list those things all very nicely for you. And you can also look this up on the NARA catalog. But again, we know from Tom Jones it was created by a crazy person. So this makes it much, much easier. All right. And then it's also listed on Ancestry.com under United States Pensioners. But this is what I want you to notice. Look how Ancestry names this. So again, Ancestry is going to list this with this name, and then on their record page, it's going to say original source, and then it's going to have that with the microphone. Okay, final payments. They are listed on, not all of them, but what they have an index on toll-free final payment pensions. All right, bounty land records. The bounty land warrant card for Whittington Clifton is found in his pension file. Now, one of the things that I want to make sure that you do when you go down to NARA is if you find any piece of documentation, I'm just trying to, I just want to see what time we're at. Oh, here we go. Because I need to keep an eye on it, and I can never move that. Okay. You always need to make a photocopy of it. If you find something that is leading you to believe that NARA should have a document, make a photocopy of it and bring it with you. Because I was at NARA and I was told, no, that's not here. Because I asked for it and they said, no, it's not here. And then I had my photocopy and I showed it to them and they looked a little harder. And lo and behold, it was in the oversized record file. So indeed, it wasn't with the other records. But they didn't have it. If I didn't have that to say, I'm not going to let you brush me off, they may have done exactly that. Now, I have found most people at NARA to be very helpful, but you never know if somebody's had a really bad day and they're excessively grumpy. And so that's when you want to make sure that you have all the evidence of anything you think should be there. All right. Now, when we look at this, we're going to look at several things. We're going to look at the warrant number, the amount of acreage, and that's indicating that he applied for bounty land and he got it. And this is, let's go back. And this is telling you the number of acres. Now, not all the bounty land records have been indexed. Underneath. So you are going to need three pieces of information. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. I have another slide. So, all right, bounty land records. We have bounty land applications. You can find them on toll-free under Revolutionary War Pensions. And there was no bounty land for the Civil War. So people got bounty land up until the Civil War. Because we were running out of land. It was great. When they were trying to recruit people for the Revolutionary War, offering bounty land was a fabulous way to get people to sign up. Because we're going to be giving you a whole lot of land for your service. But what they didn't say is, oh, by the way, if we lose, you are out of luck. So, yes.
Did they also give citizenship or naturalization to
citizens? They did not give citizenship. They may have lowered the amount of time that you had to live in this country, but they did not give citizenship.
Thank you.
So you still had to go about applying for it. Okay. So, bounty land applications, full three. And NARA, most of the bounty land applications are interfiled with pension applications, and that's record group 15 on microfilm and 804. Then you also have Ancestry's Revolutionary War Pension Index. Unindexed bounty land file, application file. And this is where you need those numbers. Okay. And we are looking at bounty land surrender warrants. And that's going to be record group 49. And the surrender, okay, this is where it's going to get confusing with bounty land. You're going to find information on bounty land in two totally separate record groups. One is when they apply for it and they get this warrant.
And then if they decide indeed to get the land, then they surrender that warrant and they go through the whole land application process. But that whole portion of it and the surrendered warrants are going to be under the Land Record Office. Totally different area. So bounty land application is going to be under military records and the surrendered warrants is going to be under land records. Two different places. Now, lots of people got their bounty land warrant, which said you indeed are entitled to 100 acres, and you are entitled to that 100 acres in Ohio, and you're living in Delaware, and you have no interest in moving to Ohio. So you say to somebody, I will sell you this warrant for so much money. So many, almost most of the people that actually lived on the land were not necessarily the soldier. So keep that in mind. All right. Now, the ones that are on index, okay, and then you will also find U.S. War Bounty Land Warrant 1789 to 1858 on Ancestry. This is a bounty land warrant, and we're going to see three things on it. We're going to see the certificate number, which is 10735. We're going to see 100 acres, and we're going to see an act of Congress the 9th day of July, 1788. Why are those three things important? Because if you want to find the surrendered warrants, you have to have these three numbers because that's how they are indexed. So you have to have the warrant number, the acreage of land, and the last two digits on the year of the act. So always make note of this. Again, with something like this, I photocopy it, I bring it with me. All right, state resources. We have Pennsylvania State Archives, and we have Delaware State Archives. And I have their websites. The Pennsylvania State Archives has incredible military records online, and you need to thoroughly investigate those. They have it for all different conflicts. For the Revolutionary War, the one I brought in, I did some work for a client, for somebody, for the Revolutionary War. And granted, I got an awful lot from his Revolutionary War pension application. We were really lucky, and that was right on the whole grid. But I would not have gotten any of his militia records. Now, unfortunately, I didn't have any active service in the militia, but I did get all of his drilling and marching practices. So that gave me a whole lot of information. It gave me a really funny record. Basically commenting on how did they phrase it? I need to read it to you because it's really funny. He basically applied, when you were in the militia, you had, if you were from the age of, Frank, help me, is it 1852? For the militia to march, the ages, I think it's about that. 53, okay. So with that one, it's very funny. All right, so in other words, he was supposed to, you would have to march so many times a year, practice in the militia. And apparently he was sick one time, so he couldn't. And so if you didn't show up, you got fined. And so he appealed this, saying, hey, look, it says, in his appeal, it says, William Peck, 8th class, under Captain Warp, says he has a fever and A at this present time and is unable to march. Are you ready for what the judgment said? I love this. March or pay his fine, as he has never done anything hitherto but skulk from place to place. Now, that was in the state records. I thought that was amazing, because that was giving me a for that information. Now, the State Archives has a lot online, but then a lot of the cards that they have online are referencing the original documents out of Harrisburg. So you really need to check the same thing with Delaware, same thing with New Jersey, and wherever state you're searching. You really need to understand the state records, talk to the archivists there, because they will have so much more than you think. And again, you may not find anything at the federal level, and you may get a boatload of information at the state level. You never know. All right, more state records, state militia records, state pension records. Lloyd DeWitt Brock, someone say that for me, please. Thank you. Has a wonderful book called Revolutionary War Pensions Awarded by State Governments. So you even got a pension from your state. So you could get a federal one and you could get a state one. And again, you want to look at what the application was. You want to look and see if they have any payment ledgers. All of this will help you. And then also state bounty land. He also wrote a book that indicates what land grants were awarded by various state governments, and that is on the ancestry. All right, you're going to find military records in specialty libraries and museums. I'm just going to name a few here. The David Library of the American Revolution, the United States Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle, the Museum of the American Revolution, and the United States West Point Military Library. Are these all the ones? No. This is just to give you a sample, depending on what you're looking for and where, what the geographic location is. There may be others there that are fabulous. You need to investigate. All right, historical and lineage societies. The Historical Society of Pennsylvania. We have some amazing military documents here that you should look for. Daughters of the American Revolution, Washington, D.C. Sons of the American Revolution, and the Society of Cincinnati, Washington, D.C. So you want to check all of these places. And internet sources, the Civil War Soldiers and Sailors System. That's run by the National Park Service. And you have Rev War 75 to locate quarterly books. We actually have a whole run of quarterly books here. Those were books that were kept by a unit, the day-to-day, almost diary. So your person's name may be in there. You gotta look for them. The AmericanRevolution.org and the Revolutionary War Unit Histories and Personal Narratives. Now, these are, other than the top, these other ones are focused on the Revolution. There are so many Civil War ones, we wouldn't have time to go through. The wonderful things about military records is you get real military buffs that live and eat and breathe this. And they create their own little websites. So you want to try and check those out. Do you believe everything they said? No. But you try to verify it, and if it makes sense, and if other things are adding up, then they may have pointed you in a direction you didn't know to go. All right, other government offices and organizations and resources, veterans assistance groups, American Red Cross, State Adjutant General's Office, the State Archives, and then family records, both narratives and letters. Make sure you're talking to your cousins. They may be able to tell you something. All right, now, we're going to go off on a little tangent here. I just want to tell you some of the stories you can find. This is my grandmother, Sarah Hopkins, and she was in the Army Nurses Corps. And this is one of her documents that talks about her service. This is my grandfather, John M. Cruz. This is one of his assignments. There he is in that wonderful uniform. He either looks like a chauffeur or he's going to be riding somewhere. But he was in the medical officer's corps. The wonderful thing is that they were married on 3rd of October, 1918. And they were married in Treforce, France. And I didn't know what the situation was. Well, apparently they were both serving at base hospital number 10. And so I actually did a little investigating, and apparently the hospital or organization that was responsible for staffing it and setting up base hospital number 10 was Pennsylvania Hospital, right down here. So do you know how many boxes of archives they have on base hospital number 10 in Three Forks, France? 11. They have 11 boxes of information about the operations and the personnel at base hospital number 10 in Three Forks, France. So are you ready for some of the things I found when I looked? I could tell you every single day my grandmother was on duty as a nurse over there, and when she was absent. And by looking at those days really carefully, you know what I was able to figure out? When my grandmother was menstruating. Amazing. Now, you may not want to know that information, but this is the kind of thing that if you look, you can find it. Another thing that I found in those 11 boxes, to keep morale up, it was very clear that they had big celebrations in different, not just for Christmas, but Flag Day, or I don't know, what's another little holiday, U.S. little holiday?
May Day.
May Day, anything, all kinds of things. So they would have dinner, and all the personnel, I guess the nurses, doctors, whomever, they would make all kinds of wonderful programs, and they would write poems, and they would get up and entertain one another. And there was one poem that mentioned how sorry they felt for this man who was the roommate of Jack, who snored so horrendously. I knew that was my grandfather. I knew that was him because my father snored so horrendously, and my grandfather was referred to as Jack, and when I did a little more digging, I wasn't finding anybody at that particular time, one of the doctors that was referred to as Jack. So I didn't know my grandfather snored that way, but now I do, and it makes sense because my father snored so horrendously. These are some of the things that you're going to find if you look. The other thing I found is that the day they were married was the day before my grandfather was being shipped out to another unit. He was reassigned. And so they were married, and because they were married, she had to come home.
Where did you find the box again?
That was at the archives at the Hospital of Pennsylvania.
Really? So it wasn't it wasn't even a military...
Ah! Is the light bulb going off? Are you hearing what I'm saying? Do not just look for military records in military organizations. They're all over the place.
What led you to Huff?
Not Huff. This is Pennsylvania Hospital down at... Yes, Avery Springs. So,
what led you to that?
I actually have done some research. And what do I suggest that everybody does? Thank you. I Googled base hospital number 10, Three Forks, France. And all of a sudden I saw that they were... That I realized, okay... The hospital that was responsible for this was Pennsylvania Hospital. And then I contacted them, and I said I was looking for information on base hospital number 10, Three Forks, France, in World War I. And they said, oh, do we have records for you? I haven't gotten through all 11 boxes. So this is what I'm telling you. Don't just look for military records in military organizations. Yes?
When you're going through a big record collection like that, you find all these details about every day you're examining. Do you try to copy all those records or just note them that are there? Just the ones you absolutely need?
If you're talking about 11 boxes, some of it I've gone through pretty fast.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that when I don't have children at home and my mother, isn't feeling better and I'm not teaching as many classes, that I won't go back there and really go through. But for now, I was moving through it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So, all right, now, How you find military records? First of all, you want to gather all the known information on the research subject. You want to identify what years they were most likely or most eligible to serve. Based on those dates, you want to identify which conflict they would most likely served in. And then you want to identify which state they were most likely to have enlisted. These are some first steps. All right. And then you want to do as much research from home as possible. Ancestry, family search, toll free, state online records. You want to print out any indexed information. You want to identify records and archive locations for particular conflicts. You want to visit the archives.gov, which is NARA. And you want to obtain any microfilm or planned visit if you need to identify where it is. All right, and again, print out any or all indexed information. And this is the National Personnel Records Center. One of the things you need to understand is this is not like the National Archives. I think they are starting to get a little more user-friendly. But it used to be the majority of this, they don't want you looking for. These are private records you're not accessible to. But what you need to understand with these is only the service individual or the next of kin can request records prior to 62 years after they separated from military service. And then the records become public records, public archives. And there are various forms. We've got DD forms, 214, a standard form, 180. And if you want to research in person, you have to make an appointment. I have heard that they may have changed that. But again, this isn't like the National Archives where you just decide to go and you can walk in any day. All right, this is the standard form 180. I'm just going to show you this. All right, one of the things that I want to tell you about this is if there's any way that you can apply as the next of kin, that's what you want to do. And I'm going to tell you what I did. I am not the next of kin for my father or my or either of my grandfathers. My mother is. But I filled out all the, and if you're applying as next of kin, guess what? You can apply online. They don't charge you. And they're really fast. So I filled out the forms online as next of kin. And where they say, why do you want these? Do you want this for awards? Do you want this for health reasons? Do you want this for legal reasons? Do you want this for pension benefits? Do you want this for genealogy? And then they have an other box. What do you think I fill out? What was that?
The other box.
I do. I check the other box with a really big X and I write, I want every document in this file. I don't want them picking and choosing for me. I want it all. And then I send that in and they send you a form back. They email you a form and I have to get my mother's signature and fax that back to you. All legal, but that way we were the next of kin, we weren't charged anything, and my father, I was very lucky. His record survived for World War II. If it's a question, I'll take it, but we'll really run it down.
Did you pretend you were your mother? You said she signed it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
I just filled out the forms. I'm not pretending to be anyone. I'm doing this totally legally. I asked her permission. I said, can we apply for these? Yes. I filled out the forms, and she signed, and we got it. All right, so please do that if you can. All right, unfortunately, the National Personnel Records Center, there was a fire in 1973. And unfortunately, the records that were affected, Army personnel discharged between November 1st, 1912 to January 1st, 1960, 80% were lost, and that's estimated. And then for Air Force personnel discharged September 25th, 1947 to January 1st, 1964 with the names alphabetically after Hubbard, James E., 75% were lost. I was lucky. We were crews. So I got everything on my father. I could tell you what teeth he had filled when he was in the service. I could tell you the date he saw that film that they call the hygiene film, that basically said, don't sleep with prostitutes. So if you want all this, you can get it if it has survived. That's a big if, I know. All right, and of course, I'm not even going to go through this. All right, and just so you know, there are advantages and disadvantages. You can mail away for the narrow record request. If you mail away, it takes longer. And these prices, don't quote me on, they've probably gone up. But if you pay $25, they're going to give you, let's see, if you pay $25, you will get the first eight pages that they think are genealogically significant. But if you pay $75, they'll send you everything up to, I think it's 100 pages. So you can mail away for these. However, I would strongly recommend you go down there. One of the things that has been one of the biggest thrill is handling some of these documents. So for the pension records, and here's the really sad thing, you want to go sooner rather than later. Once they digitize these, they will not let you handle the originals unless you have a very specific reason that you must. So I'm so glad I've gone down and I've handled these documents. I'm touching the same document that Samuel Hunt Priester put his axe on. I'm handling the same document that Elizabeth Clifton signed to get a widow's family. Widow's family land. So I would highly recommend you do that. Not only that, if you find that this pension is leading you to other records, you're right there. And that's going to lead us to a story that I have. And that was with my Joseph W. Clifton, my dad boy. And we're going to zip through this, and then we get to pass out our certificates. And I'm sorry we're not taking a break, but we have so much to cover. I hope you don't mind. And I figured we're having little refreshments afterwards so you could sustain yourself. All right, so he enlisted in 1861 in Trenton, New Jersey. He was mustered in later in the month of August. And he was in several battles. He was in the Battle of Williamsburg in 1862, the Battle of Chickahominy in Virginia in 1862, and the Battle of Malvern Hill in 1862. But then he was hospitalized in Chester in 1862, complaining of horrible stomach pains. Now, one of the things you need to know was one of the major disabilities, the most common disability after the Civil War. Well, they say it was not dysentery, it was chronic diarrhea. They don't know if it was dysentery, but chronic diarrhea. And so there were a lot of things that went undiagnosed. All right, so he's hospitalized. Unfortunately, in the records, it's indicating he deserted. He was there in August, and then on December 6th, he deserts. And now, he did say that he thought, because he was in pain, that he was going to be discharged. So then, rather than waiting around at the hospital, he just decided to go home to Burlington, New Jersey, and wait for the discharge over there. Unfortunately, he was not discharged. So in July of 1863, he is brought back under guard. Because at one point, somebody sees him over in Burlington, and they say, Joseph, why aren't you with your unit? And I'm sure he explained what he thought was going to happen, and the person said, no, go back to your unit. He did not. So then he was escorted back to his unit under guard. And he joined them, the New Jersey Infantry, at Mount Pleasant, Maryland. Unfortunately, we have a second desertion. And that was only...
4 days later.
Yes. Okay. And he deserts in Virginia. And it takes him from July to October to catch up with him in West Philadelphia. And he was arrested. He is then court-martialed in Washington, D.C. in December and sentenced to be shot to death, carried out on the 29th of January, 1864. Pretty harsh. However, one of the things that Lincoln said was, one of the things you need to understand is that we love to fancy ourselves as having been on the right and just side in the city of Philadelphia for the Civil War. However, there were an awful lot of business people, bankers particularly, in the city of Philadelphia that were not so fond of this war, because all the Southern cotton money was kept in the banks of Philadelphia. And so they knew that if the North won, that cotton money was going to dry up. So what a lot of people did, they hired other people to convince the young soldiers to desert. They'd take them out for drinks. Sometimes they'd even pay them. We'll pay you $20 if you desert. So that was one of Lincoln's frustrations, that he unfortunately had to punish the individuals that had endured such hardships, but he couldn't get after the real culprits. 1 in 7 Union soldiers deserted in the Civil War. All right, so at that point, the citizens of Burlington, New Jersey, in December, all start writing, petitioning, saying, please pardon this person, please pardon this person. And I love that this is from his wife. And she writes, for though he may be erring, I am his wife and love him still. And how can I endure the thought of the father of my 5 little children being taken out, not to fall by a foeman's hand, but to be cut down by the hands of one of his comrades?
How did you find this letter, Sydney?
Because he was court-martialed, and in the court-martial file that's right at the National Archives, all these things are in there.
Wow.
So may I hope you all have family members that are federally court-martialed. All right, this is another one that I love. This was Hannah trying to defend him. I don't think it worked so well. He was under the influence of that bane of human, good, strong drink, when he was first turned from his duty. And the dread of punishment has had much to do with his subsequent desertions. I don't want Hannah to be my defense attorney. And another one, I love, this is my favorite. As a physician, I've attended the family Clifton, and I've known him for many years. And in all of this time, I have and do believe him to be weak in mind, eccentric in character, and far close. And that's why I really, really hope that the gene pool has been sufficient from Joseph Clifton to now. But again, I don't know whether this was somebody trying to get him off or whether indeed he did have those attributes, if you want to call them attributes. All right, and then this was the one that I found. It was an article that appeared in the Washington Post on the 4th of November, 1894. So that's a long time after the fact. And it says, this is a letter from Virginia Clifton, who's my 3rd great-grandmother, to the President Lincoln. To His Excellency, the President of the United States, most honored and excellent sir, how shall a child like me attempt to write you on such business as this concerning my father, who was sentenced, oh, how can I write it, to be shot? Spare his poor life, I beseech you, and many thanks shall be given you. If his life is taken, my mother cannot stand that heavy blow, and will soon go also. I am the eldest of 5 children. I have 3 sisters under age 8 years of age. Please do not leave us fatherless. I beseech you. I would freely give my life to save it. Virginia Clifton. Now, when I read this in the National Archives, I just burst into tears. Because I didn't see the name until I came to the end. These are some of the things you may find if you look. But you have to look. Now, as it turns out, because of all of this, under Special Order Number 14, his execution was suspended until further orders. Then it was mitigated under Special Order 166 to imprisonment during the war at Fort Jefferson in Dry Tortugas, Florida. Then he starts writing home, and I love this one. He said, I cannot say that I am well, for I've got the scurvy in one of my legs, and oh, how I do dread the hot season to come. So the family's getting a little nervous, but I love this letter. It says, we do not get much here to eat, We do get a little slice of bread and about 2 ounces of salt beef for breakfast. And that stinks so that we cannot eat it. And the bread is full of little bugs and worms. And we do get a pint of something what they call coffee. And we do get about the same quantity for dinner. But we do not get any meat for supper. So again, all of this is adding an incredible amount of richness to my genealogy search. I would have never known it if I hadn't investigated the military records. And then, of course, with that letter that says he is scurvy, we know if he is in Dry Tortugas, Florida, and he spends the summer down there with scurvy, most likely he is going to come out at the end of the summer and buy that. So the family is concerned, and 93 citizens from Willis, Delaware write, and they petition the president. And then on the next page I find, I earnestly recommend the pardon and release of this soldier by George P. Fisher, who Lincoln had appointed to the judiciary. And then underneath it, pardon A. Lincoln. And here it is. But look at the date when it was pardoned. Is that significant?
Yep.
That's the day before Lincoln was assassinated. He was a lucky, lucky man. So, yes, he may have gotten out with everybody else because it was the end of the war. But these are stories that exist in your family, but you have to uncover them. I knew nothing about this story. My mother knew nothing about this story. My grandmother knew nothing about it. I think this story died with Virginia Clifton. There was so much shame involved with this story. This is not something that you can be proud of and tell people.
How much longer did he live?
He died in 1910. But the interesting thing is that you could tell that this family was a family in crisis. You could see it in the records. Some of the children did not do very well. One of the daughters was ordered to prostitution in order to feed her children. But again, if you have hungry children, you do what you have to do to feed them. But so, if I hadn't found this, it wouldn't have helped me understand what was going on with that family after the war. So I hope all of you will take the time to investigate the stories that exist in your family, whether they come from military records or other records. It's better than fiction every time. Questions? Yes, Sarah.
How do you reconstruct a file?
All right, the way you would reconstruct a file, one thing that I didn't show you, I think I've talked to you about it before. One of my favorite records right now in Pennsylvania is the Pennsylvania Veterans Compensation Records for World War I, World War II, and Mexican? Yes. And they are wonderful because what happened is a lot of people whose records have been destroyed in that fire, they indicate when they enlisted, they indicated when they separated, they indicated that they went overseas, they indicated what battles they were in. They didn't necessarily name the exact unit, but some of them did. And based on the information they gave you, you may be able to figure out the unit. And then what do? You do research on the unit. And you see what you can find. So you end up reconstructing records. If you go after the unit records, you are going to find references to different soldiers at different times. My grandfather's World War I records, I have no idea. I knew he told a wonderful story that everybody wanted him, all the officers and generals wanted him because he knew how to type. And so they ended up sharing him, and the way he would go from one place to another is they gave him his own little motorcycle with a sidecar and a driver to drive him around to the different places so that he could type the records up for one officer and then type them up for another. And I didn't know where this was. Through the Pennsylvania Veterans Compensation Record, I was able to determine when he enlisted, when his separation date was, and that he served in a supply camp down in South Carolina, Jackson, South Carolina. So he never made it overseas, and he only served for 3 months. But I'm so grateful that that 3 months, he ended up getting $40 for his compensation. But I was very grateful because he gave me much more. And although I haven't gotten into all the records yet, I know what that's on another one of my to-dos. So I hope you will totally take apart and investigate all these records. So let's get to the important thing here. And that is chocolate, of course. And I did want to show you, these are the